Well, hi, everybody. How are you today? This is Mark Ceffardini. Thank you so much for coming back to the Ghost Seat Talk podcast experience. Oh, we are one day away from Thanksgiving, and I can tell you the one thing I am the most thankful for, aside from my family, is music. It's helped me in ways that you wouldn't believe. It adds intangible grittiness and gravitas to any picture, movie, TV show it's associated with, and when you're some of the best in the business, you make it look easy. Composing can be an alien job to some. These composers end up being hidden figures, but they work so fast, they're gone in a flash, and shazam, next thing you know, they worked hard until dawn, working on the things that will stay in your ears, your DNA, or years to come. So we are privileged to speak to one of the very best doing it, a sonic killer of killers, Benjamin Wallfish. Thanks for being here. How are things in your world?
I am blown away by these inferences. Bravo. But I'm great, man. Thanks so much for having me. Good to speak to you.
No problem. Well, you know, one thing I've always admired about you is even going back to like Conquest 1453. It's, you know, you have just a way of, you know, some people have to be told to do something epic, or I'm sure that's a buzzword that gets thrown around a lot. It just seems to come naturally. You have a flair and layers of depth with your work. Has that always been with you, or did you have to like work up to that?
Honestly, I've had to kind of like tame it. I used to go way too big, and there was, I think in The Flash we had, I think at one point, 19 layers of orchestra, just something completely outrageous. And I remember when we were trying to mix it thinking, does this really add like much? And the next score I did the exact opposite, and I realized, actually, you know what, let's just go back to the basics and try and get everyone to play together. I mean, there's also a product of COVID where everyone had to play on, you know, separately, different sections of the orchestra, first strings, brass, etc. And yeah, I mean, it's so much fun when you get a project which kind of demands something of a really large scale, but it's, I would say, even more challenging to do something on a small scale. And you know, I think something like Derry, Welcome to Derry, was a unique challenge in that respect, because we had the precedent of our quite large orchestral scores. But the story was so different and demanded a much more personal approach for certainly in the earlier episodes. And so we were using string quartets and much smaller groups. And sometimes you can get like, you know, the word epic is so, it has so many meanings for so many different people, I guess. But you can definitely get very big and intense musical outcomes from very small means. If you certainly, it's all down to the musicians in the end. That's the thing. As composers, our sort of secret weapon is we can write these notes, but half of the emotion comes from the performances that we're so lucky to get from these amazing players, if we're lucky enough to use them.
And where in your experience or your education did you learn that? Because you're right, if you draw something on a piece of paper, it means something to you, but you have to hand it over to somebody who that's their bread and butter. So I guess, how did you learn to work with other players?
Are you talking about like orchestration and working with orchestras, that kind of
thing? Exactly.
Yeah, so I was very lucky to grow up in a family of classical musicians, and all of my training was actually to be in that world, in the classical world, as a piano player, as a, you know, as a composer, and also as a conductor. I spent most of my 20s actually conducting orchestras, not in the film music sphere, just regular classical concerts. And that for me was an amazing formative time. Around that time, I was lucky enough to be mentored by Dario Marianelli, the great Italian composer who wrote scores like Atonement and Pride and Prejudice, Anna Karenina. And I was his right-hand man for about 7 years, and conducted and orchestrated his music. And at the time, I didn't know there was such a thing as an orchestrator, having come from the old school classical world where, you know, you spend a year writing one piece that's performed, you know, in a concert hall. And this business of like watching Dario use an orchestra as a voice for the characters, and how he weaved around dialogue so elegantly and effortlessly, and the complexity of his writing, the polyphony, the counterpoint, the way he's the melodies, you know, the phrasing of the melodies tend to overlap. It's very really beautiful, complex writing, but it has the appearance of something quite simple and always meant to be in a way. And so I learned so much from him in terms of how to apply that kind of more hardcore classical stuff, where I, you know, I was really into all the, you know, Penderecki and Lutoslawski and Ligeti and Messiaen, Stravinsky. That was my great passion throughout my 20s. And he kind of allowed me to see how that passion could be applied in a narrative way. And then I was just so immensely lucky then in my 30s to be in touch with Hans Zimmer, and he became my mentor for 4 or 5 years and had an unimaginably big impact on me as a person, as a musician, as an artist. And I learned everything really in terms of the how to do this now on a much bigger scale. And yeah, such an amazingly generous guy. Most, you know, he has, as he has been for so many composers, get their footing as artists, especially. So I think that's, I've just been very lucky to have been exposed to some incredible, amazing people who've helped me figure out what it is to write music. And each score for me is a fresh challenge. And I'm always trying to, I don't really want to repeat myself. Sometimes you do tend to fall into certain chord progressions. And, you know, Andy, my dear friend Andy Muschietti, and I have an ongoing joke, every score has forbidden chords in it, which he, you know, I try and sneak in, he decides what they are. And he always calls them out. But, you know, it's all about collaboration. I think that's what I learned from Hans so viscerally, is this idea that we're not composers, we're filmmakers, and our department happens to be music. And our job is to create things that these filmmakers can't necessarily imagine themselves, and surprise them with our, you know, bold ideas, which have the right to be bold, like not just for the sake of it. It has to come from inside the story, and, you know, something which is going to give a perspective that may be surprising or might just call attention to something which only music could be. Something you can't say with dialogue or visual.
Well, I like how you were given some advice that might have changed your mindset. And it's kind of like, I think every industry needs, whether it's an analogy or something to sort of get you out of your zone. But I mean, I guess more to that point, do you have any more takeaways, little bits and nuggets that you're like, hey, if I wasn't told this by, you know, this contractor or this by my, you know, by my mom a long time ago, I wouldn't have thought this. Wow.
You know, it's there's so many. I'm always in student mode, and I hope to be to the very end. I'm always trying to learn from people I admire, and especially from musicians. Having grown up with musicians, the way music was treated in my family home was not just as a job. It was kind of like a culture of the family. And my grandfather Peter, who died when I was 14. He was a concert pianist and a really amazing musician. He struggled a lot. You know, he would spend weeks on a particular phrasing, turn of phrase in a piece of Schubert. And it would just, he was obsessive about, you know, making the piano sing as if it's a string instrument. And I remember he wrote me this letter when I was about 12. It was, I'd said to him once, like, how do you play so fast on the piano? Because I was trying to be him basically as a piano player, and I couldn't do it. And his response was to give me this book of etudes by Czerny, which are famously quite arduous, and, you know, it's like drill sergeant stuff, but very important to get like fundamental technique nailed for piano playing. And he wrote a sort of preface for me, especially, like, you know, instructions for use, especially for Dear Ben. And I think I can remember it because I've read it so many times. And, you know, to be read Adagio Molto, I remember he said. And the thing which really stood out is that music is a living thing with a heart and lungs, and you've got to treat it as such. And so our responsibility as composers is to somehow be conduits for something which will become alive for everyone who listens to it. And everyone who listens to it will experience it in their own particular way. And of course, all the musicians who perform it, it might be performed several times by different players. They'll all play it in a slightly different way and inject their own artistry into it. So it's a conduit music for human expression that is so powerful, because both the means of creating it and sound and the way it's received is unique to everyone. And it has all of the beautiful chaos that humanity has imbued inside of it. And I love the fact that I remember when he played the piano, there was this sense of breath always in phrasing. And it was very natural. And I remember that really helping me when I was conducting to synchronize, 100 musicians. It was all about breathing with them. Wasn't necessarily what you do with your stick and your hands. It was all to do with your breath and your eyes. And I was super lucky in my early 20s to be mentored by some amazing conductors like Edward DeVart and Valery Gergiev, who conduct only with his eyes. And all these little experiences working with orchestras, conducting Beethoven 9 or Mahler or whatever, every single time I would be learning about the potential of an orchestra, but also just how visceral, because when you conduct at that level, you have to memorize the score, like everything in it. And that takes weeks or months. And that process, you're really internalizing this music, and not just the melodic or harmonic content, it's the technical elements, how balance is handled in like a Brahms symphony, for example. His tendency was to slightly over thicken things. And I think he even writes about that in some letters. And like how to balance that so it doesn't sound overwritten. And then of course, fast forward to all of the many hours I spent with Hans. I mean, I'm not exaggerating when I say every single day I spent with Hans Zimmer, I would learn something profound. There would be something he'd say or do that I would watch, and it would be, oh my God, of course. Or it would lead me to think about all kinds, and that's literally not an exaggeration. Every day there'd be something significant that I would try and internalize and try and improve myself with as a kind of student, I guess, of his approach to life and music. So, and I don't want that to ever stop. I mean, that's kind of I'm not going to preach, but my personal view is that we have a kind of duty to music as something that it's a lifelong search for our particular version of it. The composer that's inspired me the most, John Williams, the fact that he can spend weeks refining a melody until it feels like it's always existed.
Mm.
And yet his writing appears to be so effortless and fluent and just completely perfect and just flows. Just the admiration you have to have for the fact that the guy works so hard to create that impression, and nothing comes for free. That's an incredibly long answer. So hopefully there's something in there which is of use.
No, that's great. And I think, I've been a fan of Hans's work for a long time. And I remember watching some of the happy hours that he used to do with you and David Fleming in his studio. And that was fun to watch. But he said something which stuck with me. He says, use language that is emotionally clear. And that's just a way of, conveying what you want to sort of, because art is the elicitation of emotions. Where for you is the line between technicality and emotion?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because when you're talking about music, and if we're talking about technicality in terms of like compositional techniques or maybe production techniques, because as film composers, we're delivering recordings, we're not just delivering printed scores. In my view, you can't have one without the other.
Okay.
Because anything I'm trying to do technically, because I'm not a huge fan of pushing the boundaries of production on a more technical side of things, that all comes from a narrative need. So,
fair.
For example, I remember when I first heard, I can't remember where it was. I think it was Abbey Road. I heard an Atmos mix a long time ago of an orchestral piece. I think it might have been Violin Concert. It was Anne-Sophie Mutter, John Williams, I think Leia's theme, I think it was. And I just had never heard anything like it in terms of recording. And I thought, what am I listening to? And it was explained, this is Atmos. And I was like, oh, it's the thing that they did for sound effects. And I realized, like, this is the future. This is, and I went a bit overboard and I built an Atmos studio in Santa Monica with 28 or 24 speakers, I can't remember. And it was a total midlife crisis thing. But it was all to kind of try and recreate that experience, I remember. And that was all because of the emotional hit that had on me, hearing just not just the music, which I was familiar with, but the way it was recorded and the impacts sonically it had. And of course, Sean Murphy's genius with how he mixes it all and records it. So for me, there's like a, you can't really have one without the other. I think it's the same with playing an instrument. You know, technique is something you have to have for it to somehow then become invisible and disappear, so that the only thing on the surface is the emotional power of the music that you're trying to play. That was, funny enough, coming back to that note that my grandfather wrote to the Czerny etudes, the preface, it was all about that. It was like, the point of this, these so-called exercises, is for the technique to be something you just don't notice, and you can just concentrate on what you want to say musically, which ultimately is an emotional act, because of course music's language is emotion. And sure, it's universal to all humans. And so we're very lucky, I guess, to work in that sphere where we can geek out all the time on all the technical aspects of how. And this is not new. I mean, you think about Beethoven, obviously not making any sense of comparison to Beethoven, but he was all about the technology. That, you know, he pioneered the hammer clavier, you know, which was for him this incredible revelation from the forte piano. And he wrote an entire sonata celebrating it. And of course, Johann Sebastian Bach with the 48 Preludes and Fugues, that was to celebrate this invention of equal temperament, where every key was in tune, whereas previously it was all, you know, it was absolute tuning where only certain keys were in tune, etc. And Wagner with his theater in Bayreuth, which was kind of I like to think of this as like the first Atmos sort of philosophy. Like, he was thinking about, I need a place, a space in which this will sound so enormous. How is that going to happen? And so he invented the architecture of that place. He even invented instruments, his Wagner tuba. So that's all about technology of the time. And we're just kind of following in those footsteps, using all of these amazing, just ridiculously powerful things that we can do now with just a laptop. And, you know, yeah.
Well, that brings up an interesting parallel, I would say. You know, you have somebody who's thinking about things that couldn't be done until the technology was there, or like you said, inventing the technology. But then you have, I guess what maybe they didn't have back then was the manpower. But now, okay, I'm just going to make a side step to, we're going to breathe in some dairy air. How's that sound? We're going to go to Welcome to Dairy. And you work with us seven composers, I was noticing in the credits. So having the ability of 14 hands and then people beyond them, I guess where I'm going with this is, how are you able to utilize that staffing power when previously it might have just been you with all the technology in the world? Like, how do you lean on that?
Well, it's something which is really important when you're doing a show of that size. So if you think about the scale of it, there are eight episodes of roughly an hour. So you've got about 7 hours of music that needs to be produced. And I think we had about 4 months to do the whole thing. I was working on it for longer with Andy, all in all about a year, developing the core material. But the execution of it, just in terms of the sheer number of minutes and the quality that's expected. And then the next step is, you're not just writing a cue and then you're done. For the filmmaker like Andy, he gives incredibly brilliant notes. I mean, his notes are so helpful. I mean, I'm not just saying that to suck up. It's genuinely, every time he opens his mouth with regards to something I've written, it always makes it better. And that's, I'm saying 100% of the time. And there's a couple of times I'll pitch back another idea based on his idea, and it might, go down that road instead. But it's such a fascinating back and forth. And that's a given. When I do an Andy project, what was originally, say, 50 minutes of music can easily be three or four times that, because each cue will have four, five, six different versions until the one that ends up in the score. So you're not just really writing 7 hours, you're writing more like 30 plus hours of music all in 4 months. And that's physically impossible for one person to do at any kind of quality. So I'm incredibly lucky over the years to have, I've been trying to sort of give back in the way that I've received such mentorship, trying to do the same thing for some incredibly talented young composers who are on this team. And it's a true team effort. I can name, Alex Liu is a great example. He's someone I've been working with for many years. These are all very talented artists. Sturdivant Adams, Oli Wiedekam, who's incredibly brilliant at electronics, Sean Chen. These people are great artists, and it was also that whenever Andy had an idea, the answer is always yes, because there's an infrastructure to execute on the practical level, so that there's never a corner cut in terms of the final product. Because we, with Derry, even though it was a TV show, we decided to treat each episode as a movie, and we scored each episode individually as if it was a movie with scoring sessions. And it just became like an industry, really, because typically I'm not going to make a sweeping statement because every show is unique, but often what happens is with long form television, you can kind of repeat things here and there. That wasn't the case. There's a story that slowly evolves over these episodes, and the music has to as well. So all in all, it's really just best practice to involve a team so that you can execute and there are no corners cut. And I'm very, very lucky to have, to be working with such talented people. Sturdivant Adams, I feel like give a special shout out to, because he also produced the score alongside me. He was instrumental. And I can also just describe the process a little bit. So the key thing is that there has to be a uniform voice and a uniform concept all the way through. So everything in the score originates from material that I've created. And there's a sound and a philosophy and so every single cue that gets in front of Andy, I've had my own back and forth, if it has been delegated to one of my team, to ensure that it just makes sense in the arc of what we're doing musically. And it's really just an important thing to, I think, not stigmatize, because, I want to credit everyone. It's very important to credit where it's due. And these are great artists, and they bring a very important element of easing the process for the filmmakers. So that it doesn't, sometimes things happen so last minute. Even on the dub stage, we change things sometimes, which is the final mix, even after we've recorded it. And a big part of my relationship with Andy and most filmmakers too is just the ability to never sort of say, "Oh, sorry, man, we just don't have time now. We're out." We'll find a way. And that's really important, because when you think about what filmmakers are doing, they're working with all these different departments. Editorial, VFX, sound design, etc. Of course, with the actors too. And it's expected of them to be able to make all kinds of last minute changes. And by the way, all those departments have big teams supporting the supervising person, the head of department. And so I think it's really important to kind of embrace the fact that, when you're working at a certain level of, where the quality has to be absolutely peak and there's enormous amounts to be written, it would be crazy to go in there without infrastructure, because either you're just going to never sleep for a year, which is not going to help anyone, I also have a child, and it's important to be able to have time to not just work,
Sometimes those banker's hours are helpful, and the team helps you achieve that, so you can, put focus on what is most important.
Well, also it's more about yes, I agree. And also it's for me, I really want to just help these young talented composers, on their own journeys, by crediting them. And someone like Sturdivant, for example, is just such a talent on so many levels, and I'm mentoring him now for 3 years. Also a very sweet man, and he deserves to have the biggest career possible in this world, and I want to help him have that, almost everything I can to help him. And the same for everyone on my team. That's really important to me, is to try and give them opportunities to not have time to be on my team anymore, because they're so busy doing their own scores,
Well, I'm so glad you mentioned the process and also the idea of scoring each show or each episode like its own movie. Because what I noticed is that there's brevity and variety to what was in Welcome to Derry. I mean, you've got these odds in episode two. You've got these odd sounds where the boys are bullying a kid on the street, and then in episode four, it seems like there's some chanting in the credits. So it looks like there's an opportunity to really find moments of uniqueness in almost every minute of the show without having to feel like, okay, roll the end credits and da 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 da, you get that repeat that you say you were trying to avoid.
True, yeah. I mean, I think there's I can't obviously talk in too much detail because we're right in the middle of the season, but there's an incredible story, and it's so compelling, and it's very cinematic as well. And there are whole episodes where we used a 90-piece orchestra, which was a very extravagant thing to do, but we just decided this is what it needed, because it is astonishing how cinematic this piece is, while still maintaining the personal and intimacy that also was there in the movies, but it's particularly so when you watch it on your own screen.
Well, I truly love what you did with The Flash. So your career and your career cohabitating with Andy, so to speak, has reaped immeasurable bounty. But let's jump to another collaborator, Dan Trachtenberg. I really liked Predator Badlands, but I was blown away by Killer of Killers. And I feel like that they speak a common language, but they still couldn't be any more different because Badlands is so alien and foreign. So, I would really like to know more about Badlands and Killer of Killers, but I give you a digital high five for Killer of Killers.
Thank you.
So you have Amit Thea and then you have Tessa, which seem like, there's a point counterpoint to the two of them. Like happy ditzy go lucky and all business assassin. So like, I'm gathering that you get that from Dan and you get that from the show, but like how do you work so that a theme can be like a counterpoint to each other.
Well, that was Sarah Sachno, my co-composer. She was responsible for those two characters and did an amazing job, kind of with that counterpoint. I thought the more playful, not necessarily comedic, but just something that has a lightness of touch, and then that more kind of the Weyland-Yutani sound is something I've been very familiar with, having done Alien Romulus. And of course, there's such different movies and set in different periods of time, of course, as well. There's it needed something fresh, and I thought Sarah did an amazing job. Yeah, I mean, my input to that score was we worked a lot with, it was one of those things where we were trying different things, both of us, and it sort of naturally settled in a place where I took that there was certain action sequences and the vocalizations, the concept of a Yautja choir, which was something quite towards the end of the process that Dan wanted us to try, and we ended up putting it all over the score. Yeah, it was a fascinating journey, and we're very different composers, Sarah and I, and it was really fun to kind of bounce off each other and play to our strengths, I guess.
Yeah, and when you say that the choir, the chanting, the growling, it just felt so, like you said, it was always meant to be there. When you do it right, it feels, effortless. But I listened to the score so many times, and every time, Like, I don't know what track I'm on, but whenever I hear Infiltration come up, you've just got these drums and Infiltration. I'm like, I got, what is that song? Oh, it's Infiltration. I keep coming back to the same thing. Just
Excellent.
how brutal in a good sense it is, and how.
Right. Well, that's the thing. Dan really wanted to have the sense that this was not going to just be another, not a rehash, but just something which really exists within the arc of all the other scores. Because of course we're on a completely new planet, and we're creating a totally new perspective on what a Predator movie could be, where Predator is protagonist and someone we're rooting for, and he does it so effortlessly in the writing and the every element of the direction. And so that was kind of a really important choice we had to make, was how do we make it feel as effortless in the score? And the answer was, well, let's involve the Yautja in the score and not make it, an orchestra looking in and commenting. Let's make it coming out from the actual characters musically and integrating them into all of the fascinating sonic world of Sarah's writing and the stuff I was doing as well, which was very different to a lot of the stuff I normally do. And that was really fun. And we worked a lot with Demetrius, who plays Deck. We did a lot of recording sessions with him to get that core material. We had him sing all kinds of different lines to create the choir, and we
Oh, no way.
processed it in such a way to make it really gravelly and of what you'd expect to hear from a Yautja. And he was amazing. Great sport to do that.
I can't believe how much I liked it. Even though, I'm going to be fair and say that it feels like a lost episode of The Mandalorian, but I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. It's an adventure. It's not supposed to be as so dour as a or a haunted house in the jungle, so to speak, like the first movie. But I really like spiky plants. Really feels the most foreign, and it's just so apt that you have a character who is foreign to us, but then finding himself in a foreign element. It's like Inception. Just layers
Yeah,
of
no.
coolness and in innovation.
Well, Dan is an incredible visionary and like such an easy guy to work with. And he has some amazing people around him as well, Ben Rosenblatt and his editorial team, Ben the producer. And it's just a pleasure because it's very relaxed, but we all know we're in this room doing something completely bold that a lot of people are going to see. And we're just all really having fun. And it's a great atmosphere of camaraderie and playfulness, and we're giving each other shit all the time. It was a really great collaboration, and of course with Sarah as well. And in fact, going to the Killer of Killers project, that was the first time I've worked with Dan, and I mean that was really, really challenging. I have to say, of all the things I've ever done, it's one of the hardest because the first three chapters are in three completely different styles, musically, narratively, everything had to somehow work together, but still also be completely unique, and then all kind of somehow be meshed together in the final chapter. So it took a lot of time to figure out what that would sound like. And I actually started in the sword episode because it was really important. So that's the one with the least dialogue. And there's such a powerful family story embedded in that episode. In that chapter. So it's again super collaborative and lots of experimentation right up until the wire. Yeah, it was a really fun journey.
I'm really thankful to be talking to you. I have Alien Romulus and the Alien Romulus the suite from Mutant at home. I have Hidden Figures. I'm looking forward to maybe a day that when there will be a Predator or some sort of vinyl in the future that I will spin with the rest of my collection. But
Yeah, what's the
until that
space?
until that day comes, I want to thank you for giving life to animated mice, all the way to aliens and predators and everything in between. Ben,
Thank
you've been
you.
a treat. Just to take us out really quick, I'm sure you could do this. What are Benjamin Wallfish's 10 favorite things?
And oof.
There's no
Can
wrong
they
answer. It could be anything, like
can
this.
they include people?
Yes.
Well, my daughter, number one.
Good answer.
And it would quite easily be I'd be able to talk about 10 things that she does that are my favorite things, but but I would say, gosh, I mean that's a hard question. I would say my piano is up there somewhere. Honestly, all my friends, all the people who support me, my agent, and now I sound like I'm giving an acceptance speech or something.
Like to thank the Academy and
But I mean, look, we're so lucky to be in this field where we get to play with all these toys. And these things become part of our extensions of us. These, even the laptop, and like what's on this laptop and over there in my studio. Yeah, these are, so I'm now not answering your question, I'm sorry. I would say my coffee maker, it's definitely out there. I'm very addicted to that thing. Where I live, I'm very fortunate. And I would say just the filmmakers I've been lucky enough to work with. These are my dearest friends, and the collaborations that, you know, I've been lucky enough to have over these years has been such wonderful experiences personally as well as professionally. Now I'm going to go full acceptance speech mode. Of course, my parents. That's the problem. When you start naming people, then you're really screwed because you're going to leave people out. And of course, my little puppy.
Ah, Suki.
Of which I have two, Suki and Mochi, so puppies.
Oh, nice.
Both little Cavalier King Charles. Anyway, that's a little, I guess, a little taste of my favorite things. It's definitely not all of them.
Well, yeah, round of applause for giving us that, and round of applause for taking us to the highs and lows of the emotions in the musical sense. So best to your family this Thanksgiving, and
thank
we
you.
Will catch you next time.
Thank you, my friends. All the best.